Det är dags för kvällens första huvudtalare. Välkommen Myers.
You guys crack me up. My name is Myers and I'm an alcoholic. I took my last drink on January 15th, 88, and what an honor it is to be here. Can you guys hear me okay? You know, when we flew in here at lunchtime today, the pilots were having some contest to see how fast they could drop us off into this town, and I just like, we lost 30,000 feet just like that, and my ears got messed up, and I just... We're screwed already, because that's as slow as it gets. I'll do my best. I want to thank you guys for asking us to come do this. This is a... Some of you guys have traveled great distances to get here. I'm honored to know some of you already. And it's always fun to come to Europe and see how many people I already know that's here. And how many people that are still doing the deal, that are still in the trenches, that are still having the courage to get out there and carry a message of recovery that can affect lives. It's neat stuff. We'll be here all day tomorrow too. And so some of the stuff that we'll talk about tonight, we'll have a chance during the day tomorrow to catch up on some of this stuff. If we're talking too fast or if we miss you, we'll try to straighten a bunch of this stuff out. Maybe we'll take the CDs and play them real slow. And I don't know. I don't envy any of you trying to keep track of this stuff. From coming from Texas, I tend to talk real fast and anyway, and so it would be tough. Your language is so pretty. It's so elegant when you listen to the steps in Swedish or Danish or any of this. It always sounds so exotic. It's hard to believe that it's the same stuff. My mind just got... I was pretending you guys were a bunch of sex addicts up here and you were doing some sharing your stories about sex addiction or something. I'm not making light of any of it. But not understanding the language, it's just kind of hard to follow along. Thanks for Martin and Carl for abusing us all afternoon. I'm so honored to know those guys and so appreciative that they came to get us at the airport. And thanks for the guys that made the decisions to do this and that made the decisions to get the evil twins from Texas to come and do this. There are thousands and thousands of conferences worldwide who, given the choice of what speakers they're going to bring, will look through the list and find somebody that's real funny. And there's nothing wrong with funny. There's nothing wrong with being entertained. But we got a fellowship that's in a weird place today, worldwide. We got areas where people are doing great work and where many, many people are recovering from this deadly disease, both in addiction and in alcoholism. But we also have areas where things have gotten real strange, where you would hardly recognize it as Alcoholics Anonymous. And our sister fellowships, they've all gotten kind of convoluted. And so a lot of what we talk about is that. Not bashing the fellowship, but just trying to get people to see the reality of where we are worldwide in a fellowship that was intended to help us, and yet in some places we've gotten so... We've drifted off so far that it's not even funny. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk some specifics about that and address some things like sponsorship and some of these things that may be you may not be real comfortable with, or you may. We may learn something. We usually do. I got to say something from the guys that are in the taping community and in the CD world that are hearing this stuff, you got to see it from my perspective and see what I'm seeing like that. If I was doing a talk in East Texas, a room full of guys and gals, they look like drunks. They just look like alcoholics. When I look out across this, you guys cleaned up good. It's the prettiest bunch of drunks I've ever seen in my whole life. It's amazing, amazing. You okay, brother? He climbs stairs like I used to. I'm the only guy in the world that can fall up a pair of stairs. So you just... Unless I was getting knocked down them, I don't know. For guys that I've met, it's okay. We'll wait. Okay, I appreciate that. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group in Dallas, Texas, and it's a big old nest of Big Book Thumpers and Cliff Bishop and the rest of those cats send their love. And if you ever get a chance to meet Krusty Cliff, and I hope that you do someday, it's a deal. Wasn't always like this. I sobered up in 88, in January of 88, after a nightmarish 5 or 6 years. And fortunately, my twin brother, who's some of you guys know personally, and I hope you all get a chance to know him. Chris saved my life twice in AA. Once when I sobered up, and he brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then again 7 years later, when I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, not doing the things that I was supposed to be doing, and being spoon-fed a bunch of weird information from a bunch of people that loved me to death, and I just didn't know it. And Chris saw it and recognized it, and when it got real ugly, he was there. And so I am truly grateful. I would not be in Stockholm, Sweden, I can assure you, had he not been there to catch my scrawny rear and get me on the path that I needed to be on. Sometimes it's amazing any of us get here. It's amazing that we make it. I'm never really surprised when people sober up. I'm never really surprised when people put the drug down. But I'm surprised when their life changes so dramatically as a direct result of working a spiritual program that's guaranteed to change everything. I didn't come to AA to change everything. I didn't come to AA to so I could be a better man. I came to AA so I could quit drinking and quit doing those other nasty outside issues. That's it. And I was completely, completely caught off guard by how amazing this program was once I began to understand that the steps were geared to get me to a place that I never knew existed. I didn't know what it was like to be a kind guy. I didn't know what it was like to not be a bully. I didn't know what it was like to not be offensive. Some of you may still think I'm offensive, but I mean, you should have seen the old Myers. Oh, there's nothing more offensive than a drunk Myers Raymer. Honest, honest. I'm the guy that when you went to a party, and you were there with a date, I always had to touch her. Don't you just hate that? I'm the guy that's just going to reach over and like this. And then I would wonder why you would want to retaliate. Don't you understand? I'm just being friendly. Yeah, right. Crazy stuff. In the last 6 months that I drank, I had two brushes with the law, both of them around fights, both of them around... I tried to beat up a liquor store clerk one night, and then I tried to beat up a kid in a pizza joint one night. And neither one of them very good, especially when you're built like I am. I mean, I've seen cats with more muscle than I got. And I'm always the one that thinks that... I bet there's some scrappers out there. I bet some of you guys are the same as me. You get a couple of beers in you, and all of a sudden you got muscles where there weren't any, you know? And I get real loud, and I get this kind of obnoxious swagger when I walk in, and you know, people don't like that. People don't. So, Chris, my twin, is working with us at this bindery. I'm a bookbinder by trade, and he's working at this bindery because he's basically unemployable anyplace else, and so he's going to work there at the shop, and which is great. I loved having him. I mean, he's my best drinking buddy, and he's right there with me, and we can, you know, look at each other across the bindery, and I go like this, and it's off to the races. You see, it didn't make any difference if it was 11 o'clock in the morning, because I'm blessed with a wife who's brilliant and who is my business partner, and she runs the place better than I do anyway. So we could, Chris and I could leave, and it was great. And then right up to the point that Chris decided to sober up in November of 87, he stops drinking. One of the guys that worked for us at the shop was in AA and had been sober for 4 or 5 years. And Charlie 12-stepped Chris, and then Chris said, "Nah, I'm not quite ready." And a long story short, eventually Chris got ready. And when he did, I was devastated. I was like, "Oh, can't we talk about this? Can't we do something else here?" He was having none of it. He was done. And so I had what I had was this. They talk about AA being a program of attraction rather than promotion. In the 2 months between when Chris sobered up and I sobered up, there was never any time when he tried to sell me on the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't. And I made his life miserable. "Where's your big book, Chris?" I didn't. I'm such a turd. And I just couldn't stand the idea that he wasn't there anymore. That he wasn't there with me. Chris was always my go-to guy. He was the knucklehead, knife-wielding, maniac drunk. And I used to always go, in the deepest, darkest part of the night, I'd go, "If I ever get that drunk, I'll stop." And I bet you've got a guy like that too. Don't you have somebody like that in your life? Well, so all of a sudden he stops, and I'm going, "Oh my gosh, what am I going to do?" And so I watched for 2 months while his life changed. He was working full hour, full days. He was going to a meeting at night at 6 o'clock and come back to work at night sometimes. And I was just watching how productive his life got and how full and rich. And so after a while, I just simply couldn't stand it any longer. And I had this moment of clarity one night standing out side looking up at the moon, and I realized I'm drunk on my rear end, and I'm sucking on this bottle of vodka, and I got a 12-pack of beer sitting on the seat of this Toyota Land Cruiser that's all beat up out there by my house, and I'm just, this is it's as good as it's going to get, and I knew it, and I just said, "I can't do this. I have to stop." So I talked to Chris. He took me to my first meeting, and I fell in love with AA just like that. Absolutely loved this thing, and I bet some of you did too. I'll give you the Reader's Digest condensed version, because we're going to talk a little bit about some of this stuff tomorrow, and I don't want to dwell on it, because it was a fairly painful time. Some of you guys may recognize this. You come into AA and you immediately stop drinking, and then you get better, and you're feeling better, and your wife smiles at you again, and things just seem a little rosier, and you kind of watch it, and it would be great if it would just stay like that. The trick is, and for some of you it did, and I understand that. For some of you it did get better. But for some of you, it was like me, it got better, and then it got not so better, and then it got ugly, and then it just got absolutely toxic. The little Iceland guys used to call them dark tunnel meetings. And that's where we were. We had 21 meetings a week, and they were all discussion meetings. And we had no big book studies. We had hundreds of people in the group, but nobody knew anything about the program. We were just kind of loving each other, and it was okay. The fellowship was some of the coolest stuff I'd ever experienced. Is there anybody here that cannot remember those days when you first walked into an AA meeting and how cool it felt to just be in a room full of people that loved you, that didn't judge you, that were willing to be there for you? It's a powerful place to be. The unfortunate part is that just sitting in the meeting talking about stuff does not treat alcoholism. The fellowship is good, and I'm the poster boy for middle-of-the-road stuff. I mean, I can tell you right now, you can stay clear of the booze and the drugs for a long, long time just sitting in meetings talking about your day. You can do that. The trick always comes in, how do you... Can you do that and be happy too? Some of you can. I've seen it. I've known people that were like that. But over the last 10 or 15 years, I've met thousands upon thousands that could not, that simply got so sick sitting in meetings talking about things. The illusion was is that if I could just talk about it enough, it would get better. And momentarily it would. You'd leave the meeting feeling like a spiritual giant, and then you'd go home and you'd walk in the front door and maybe the house is not quite as clean as you want it, or you got to step over the dog, or the kid's book bag is laying in the entryway, and it doesn't make any difference what it is, but all of a sudden you're off to the races. You ever do that? You left a spiritual giant, and an hour later, you're a fruitcake. You're just a nut job. My wife used to say I was nuttier than a squirrel turd, and it took me a while to... I just... Because she never knew what was coming home. The meeting wasn't treating that. And so... It was a funny thing. It went for 7 years like that, and it got to where towards the end of it, in the early days, I was so excited to hear your story and so excited to hear all you had to share. And then 3 years into the deal, I'm looking at it going, "Oh, this is getting really tedious. I don't want to hear what you have to say, and you don't want to hear what I have to say, and I'm not really sure why we're here." And it just like, and so from 3 to 7 years, it was just. We had this guy one time came in at a group conscience meeting unannounced. He just walked in. He was a brand new guy in our group. And he walked in and he said, "I think we're talking about God too much." And we all kind of looked at each other and some guy nodded yes. And I went, "Yes." And I fell in right with him like that. And he says, "I think we ought to just not talk about God in the meeting." And I went, "Okay, yes, yes," like this. "Well, let's vote on it." This guy wasn't even on the agenda. We didn't even know who he was. But he knew how to do this, and he knew if he did it long enough, everybody in the room would start doing it too, and pretty soon, we voted God out of the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was pretty ugly. We took a meeting that was already pretty sick and took the only solution we had completely out of it. And it was a free-for-all. If you wanted to come in there and talk for an hour about your cat and that she'd crapped in the garden and blah, 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 who cares? Anyway, finally, things got crazy enough that things got toxic and I knew I had to do something. It's a funny thing, all those years of drinking and doing those other outside issues, I never one time thought about killing myself. It never even crossed my mind. And here I was 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was the only thing I could think about. It was my night and day deal. I'm one of those kind of guys that when I get really, really, when things get goofy, I get depressed. And my depression, I heard this lady one time say, "Oh, I know all about that depression. I get to feeling so blue." I'm going, "Lady, time out. I'm not talking about blue depression. I'm talking about comatose, laying in bed with the covers over my head, I can't move depression." And that's the way I was getting. And it scared me so badly, I just, God, just can't stand it. So, finally one night I almost drank and it scared me so badly that I called Chris. By this time, Chris has moved to the hill country and married this little gal, and he's got a guy that's a big book guy, which was new to me, for a sponsor. And he's teaching Chris all of this stuff. And I am completely, completely baffled by it. But I called Chris and told him what the problem was, and he said, "Don't do anything. I'm going to come up there. I'll be in Dallas." Chris lives 300 miles south of me. And he said, "I'll be there, and we'll see what we can get fixed up." And he did, true to his word. And he called me when he got in town and he said, "I found this old guy and I want you to go see him and I think he's got the solution." And I would love to tell you that I said, "Oh, Chris, thank you so much. I'm so excited to go see this old coot." But I didn't. What I said was, "Chris, I'm real busy right now. And we've got payroll to do and I've got a bunch of stuff I need to get done." And this is like total silence on the other end of the phone. And I can see Chris just going, 48 hours ago you were suicidal and you were going to try to kill yourself, and I'm giving you something as a solution and you won't go see him. Now that's arrogance, guys. That's either arrogance or the alcoholic mind at its very worst. So I went and saw this guy, and some of you guys have heard this stuff, but but my first meeting with Cliff Bishop was one of those kind of weird, surreal kind of things. This man scared the spit out of me from the moment that I met him. Some of you guys have met him in person, and I'm telling you, he was older than dirt when I met him, and that was 15 years ago. And he looks at me and he goes, "Where's your big book?" And I went, "Excuse me? What's that got to do with anything? I don't understand what he's..." He says, "Here's mine. I want you to take it and don't come back over here without it." And then he just kind of backed out of the doorway, and I was expected to walk in his house. And I'm thinking, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to? And there's... The reason I'm telling you this, the reason I'm boring you with this thing, is because I want you to understand the insidious insanity that is alcoholism had already told me that I didn't need what this man had. That I could manage just fine doing what I was doing. I'm 48 hours away from thinking about killing myself, and I've already, my ego has already rekindled itself, and I'm already a little bulletproof, arrogant pissant. That's what I am. So I'm standing there trying to decide. I can either go run out there on the street, get in my truck, and get out of there, or I can go into this guy's living room and sit there. And that's what I did. There's something inside me that tells me that he's got what I need, and he did, indeed. In 45 minutes, sitting in his living room, he taught me more about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than I knew was out there. I had no idea. If you've ever been confronted with somebody like that, he would read something, and I'd look at his book, and I'd listen to what he said, and then I'd look back at his book again, and finally he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm trying to see if you have the study edition big book." And he goes, "No, I don't. It's the same as yours." And it was. I just didn't know that stuff was in there. I thought it was the secret handshake edition, you know? And so he said, Myers, "The problem, as I understand this, is that you've spent all of these years hung up in the fellowship end of the program of our deal, but you never addressed the program itself, what was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ignored the written documentation of what it is that we were supposed to do." And immediately my dander got up. Immediately I'm getting all, you know, bowed up, you know, like, "What do you mean I don't know what I'm..." Where does this come from? And he said, "Settle down and let's talk for a minute." And he explained several things. One of the things that he explained was this thing that I hope we get a chance to talk to about this weekend. It was something called an oral tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous. In the early days, once they wrote the big book, everybody that went to AA used the big book as the baseline from which their program rose. Everything came out of the book. The way it is in the United States today, and worldwide, I might add, is that we've taken the literature and we set it aside, and we depended on the open discussion meeting, which was introduced by the Grapevine. It was not an AA invention. And that became the basis of our program. Well, if any of you guys have been around for any length of time, you remember... I bet they played that same kind of, what was it, post office or telephone or whatever that game was, like this, where I whisper into her ear, I tell her something cool, and she whispers it into Sarah's ear, and we go down here. By the time it gets right here, it's already started to move and convolute. It's already started to change. By the time it gets up here to Chris, up in the middle right here, it's really different. And you poor bastards in the back, you're just screwed. I mean, it just... You may get pieces of it, you may get not pieces of it, you're going to get... You see what I'm saying? But that's what happens anytime we try to depend on an oral tradition to show us what it is that we need to do. Now listen, don't get me wrong. There were nobody in those meetings sharing with me that meant me any malice. I never met a mean guy in AA. Never. They loved me to death. But everybody just collectively thought that we knew... This is what I'll share. And so what Chris shared and what Sarah shared and what Chris Raymer shared were all three different things. You ever notice when you walk into a group and you've got guys trying to take you through the work, how you'll have all these different variations? You'll have all of these different people doing things different ways. Some of them bear some resemblance to the doctrine, which was Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of it doesn't. You see? And so what I'm hoping we can do some this weekend is simply look at, in a large way, the doctrine that we've decided to follow in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you'll end up doing is exactly what I did, which is simply make a decision to set everything you think you know about Alcoholics Anonymous on the floor. Just set it down. And then investigate it. And then decide what's worth picking back up again. Using the big book as the baseline, or the sifter, if you will, to determine what's real AA doctrine and what's just AA BS. What's just AA opinion. That's not a hard concept, is it? You guys all understand that, right? Some people get so offended with that idea. It's just the most offensive thing in the world to talk about doing that. And it shouldn't be. It's not that we're saying that you have to throw everything you know about AA away. You just have to make a conscious decision to reinvestigate it and see if it's still real. Is it opinion or is it big book? And the result is the most dramatic thing you'll ever see in your whole life. What will come up out of that is a program that is so exciting to you that you can't believe that it was here all the time. It will be so new and so real that every day is a day you'll get up excited to be a part of this fellowship. That's not just me being flowery. That's not me just trying to make something to excite you. That's my experience and the experience of thousands and thousands of people who have done this. It's the coolest thing in the world. There will be old ideas that you will set down begrudgingly because you don't want to set them down, and I understand that. I'm telling you, years in my work at Primary Purpose Group after I left my home group and went over to this new group, it would take me years to finally set down the last pieces of old ideas that I had about recovery and about how to work men through the work and this sort of thing. Amazing stuff. So here's what happened. We have three meetings a week, and they're all big book studies. And every other night of the week, our group is out carrying the message to different places, wind-up joints, treatment centers, places that we wind up, and halfway houses, hospitals, jails. And so I'd go in there on a Tuesday, and then Tuesday night, I'd be blown away by what we learned. And Wednesday morning, I'm calling Chris in Kerrville going, Chris, you're not going to... Do you realize how long it took Bill Wilson to work the work? And he'd laugh and he'd say, yeah, I know. And we'd talk a minute and I'd hang up. Thursday night, I'd go to my meeting. Friday morning, I'm on the phone to Chris. And this went on forever. And he never crucified me. He never went, yeah, dummy, most of us figured this out years ago. He didn't say that. It was like, I'm 7 years from my last drink and last outside issue. I'm 7 years removed. And it's like I'm a brand new guy in AA. And I'm so excited. Guys, I'm telling you, it's like there are some days I sit in that meeting and I was so excited I wanted to pee on myself. I couldn't. Ah. To know and understand a program well enough so that when some little sick puke like this comes up and says, you're not a sick puke, but when some guy comes up and says, will you help me? That you have some clarity in your head what you're going to do with this guy, you know and understand, is the most amazing thing I've ever experienced. To clearly understand how to carry a guy through the work, knowing that the work itself would transform this busted up little knucklehead that was just as arrogant as I was into a man that's worth having around, is an amazing, amazing thing. You see? If you had asked me that at 7 years sober, Myers, do you understand how to carry somebody through the work? I'd have said, sure. And I bet you would too. I mean, I've been around 7 years. I ought to know, right? If they had phrased it like this, if they'd said, Myers, would you write down for me exactly what you would do to carry this guy through the work? Could you do that? Not in a million years. Not in a million years. My head tells me that I have all the knowledge I need right now to do that. The reality was, is that sitting in those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with those big book thumpers at Primary Purpose Group 15 years ago or 14 years ago, every time I'd walk out of that meeting, I'd go, God, why didn't I know that? Why didn't I? And every meeting, there'd be one more little line drawn, one more little connection drawn. And pretty soon, the dots got connected enough that I began to understand some big, important things. One was, why am I a drunk? Why do I drink the way I drink? I never pushed on the question. I'll always default back to what I really think. What do I really think? I'm a mental defective, and I'm just a little weak-willed bastard, and that's it. I just have no willpower, and that's what it is. Knowing what I should know, the literature spends 164 pages telling me that that's not the case. You don't drink because you're weak-willed. You drink because you're sick. But I don't understand it. And as we're setting those meetings, I would get so excited because I never forget the night. We were sitting in there on a Thursday night and somebody said something, somebody read something out of the book, and I went, holy cow, there it is. I'm sick. I have a mind and a body that's different from everybody else's. That's why we are like this. And I began to just kind of connect all the little dots up. And pretty soon I realized and understood for the first time in all of those years, I didn't feel weak. I felt empowered in knowing that there was something beyond my control. I did not have the power to not drink left on my own devices. And guys, if you've made that connection in your head, you're way down the road towards helping another man or another woman. If you haven't made that connection yet, welcome. Welcome. There's going to be some cool stuff this weekend, I promise you. And perhaps this will be the weekend that you'll make that connection. The other connection, the other thing that they talked about that I'd never addressed was that I was there to help somebody. Listen, how many times have you heard somebody say, well, I've had a crappy day, I can't wait to get to that meeting, maybe I'll hear something. Maybe I'll, we all want to be fed solution. And you know what? The book never says that. Our literature said that as soon as we draw a sober breath, we're there for the new guy. We're there to help somebody that just came in. We're there to help somebody. Could a man 3 days sober sponsor somebody? I don't think so. No. Even old Progressive Myers doesn't think that. But could when this man walks in the door and he's looking at the floor and he's all befuddled, could I show him where the bathroom is? Could I show him how to get a big book? Could I help him understand who the stronger members of the group are that could help him with sponsorship? Sure, all of these things I could do. This is all part of being there for somebody else. This deal that we're going to sit in a meeting and share our day ad nauseum. I'm begging you, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I believe strongly that everybody needs a place to share. I do. I just don't think that the meeting is the place to do it. I think that our sponsors would be a much, much better place to share the bad day that I just had, or the run-in I just had with my wife. I do. Because the brand new guy, this guy right here, I'm going to move later, buddy. I promise I won't keep using it as an example. He's just going, why the hell me? Why me? He's probably been sober 30 years, and I'm just going. But it's like the brand new guy that's sitting in our meeting, he doesn't care that you had a run-in with your boss. He doesn't care that you can't have a meaningful relationship with your wife. He doesn't care. There's only one thing that this man cares about. Can I get up in the morning and not drink? Can I? That's all he needs to know. Yes. And then he's going to ask the question my favorite question in AA. How did you do it? There it is. Now we're off to the races. I got me a little guy that's curious about how I recover. And he's ready to go. And there it is. It's the coolest thing in the whole wide world. But so what we need to do... Okay. I need to make this personal. Without it being personal. I don't want to offend anybody. But I want to ask you if this is what your experience has been. Because it may not. It certainly may not have been. Let me put it this way. In Texas, We'll keep it geographical to my area, okay? In Texas, we might have a group conscience meeting and we might decide that we want to try to get the meetings more literature-based and more solution-based. And so everybody's excited about the idea because deep down inside, the discussion stuff is hurting everybody. Everybody's getting a little tired of the stuff that we're talking about, the wheels-off discussion stuff. And so we set this meeting up, right? And so we're all sitting there. There's 20 or 30 of us sitting in this around this big circle and like this. And the chairman over here, the chairman, he has this great topic, step one. Now we look around the room, we got two brand new guys that just came in the meeting. They're green as they can be and they're sitting there in the deal. And everybody in the room knows what's going on. Everybody senses the coolness of what's about to happen. We have two brand new guys in the room that need a solution. Check. We have a chairman, who has a topic, step one, that's dead nuts on. Check. Everything is all lined up. The stars are all right where they're supposed to be. Everything is going to be groovy. He does this little 5-minute share, and he hits it out of the ballpark. It's dead on. These little guys are sitting forward in their chair. They're engaged. They sense that it's solution. Everybody senses it. He gets done. He passes it to the next guy. The next guy starts sharing. He knocks it out of the ballpark. He's just dead nuts on. He's not sharing any goofy story. He's just sharing stuff right out of the literature. And these guys they look like they've been bitch slapped. They're just kind of like dazed. There's real hope there, and they sense it. Even the sickest guy, guys, I'm telling you, even the wettest drunk knows truth when he hears it. He senses that it's not BS. And these guys are so excited, they're vibrating. And then there's this guy in the back of the room. Tom. Hi, my name is Tom. I'd like to share. And I know the topic is step one, but I really have something I need to share. And so he does. Tom's going through a bad divorce and he wants to share about it for the 100th time. And I'm not making light. You make darn sure you hear me well. I'm not making light of Tom's dilemma. Tom's hurting like a big dog, and I love him to death and want him to get clear of what ails him. I'm not making light that he hurts. But I want you to watch the dynamics, and maybe you've been in a meeting just like this. I want you to look around the room and watch the dynamics. As soon as Tom said what he wanted to share about, you had 30 people slide back in their chair. And two or three of them put their heads down on the table because they knew it was going to change. And so Tom goes on for 15 or 20 minutes talking about what we've already heard before about this deal. And you watch the light go out in the eyes of these two men that were sitting down front that were getting the solution. They're just glazed over again. They might as well be detoxing someplace else. They're not, you see? And so now we have this meeting that has gotten convoluted. It's like at one point we had the power of God flowing through a meeting so powerfully that anything could have happened. It could have been absolutely miracle right there in front of us. And yet we let it go south because nobody had the courage to say, Tom, hang on, buddy. We do have a topic, and it's step one. Come see me after the meeting, brother, and we'll talk about this. It could have been handled that easy. And yet it wasn't. Because we're so sold on the idea that we have a right to share anything we want to, anytime we want to, regardless of what's going on. And guys, I'm telling you right now, from the bottom of my heart, I love you to death, but that is the epitome of selfishness. What Tom did with his action was say, I don't give a rat's butt about those two men down front. I don't care. What I care about is how bad I'm hurting. Perhaps if Tom had got off his dead butt and walked down front and greeted those men and said, buddy, here's my name and telephone number. Come see me after this meeting and I'm going to show you how to get plugged into a power that is so cool and so intense that you'll think you have indeed been rocketed into a place that you've never been before. Now, wouldn't that be cool? You see? And as a result, Tom would have spent a whole 24 hours clear of the obsession to masturbate these stupid feelings of his about this divorce. No offense, Tom. No offense. few more minutes, and we're mercifully we'll be done. I won't harp on that stuff. In Australia, 98% of all the meetings in Australia are what they call identity meetings, ID meetings, talking about how we got there. That's it. So many of those meetings, there's just simply no solution there. They're just going to share how we got there. Which again may be cool for about 2 weeks, and then it gets real tedious hearing the same guys share over and over and over again about how they got there. Hold your finger on that thought. Based on what we just talked about, I want you to listen to this. This was Bill Wilson wrote this in a letter in 1966. This was published. And it says, an AA group as such cannot take on all the personal problems of its members, let alone those of non-alcoholics in the world around us. The AA group is not, for example, a mediator of domestic relations, nor does it furnish personal financial aid to anyone. Period. Now hold your finger on that thought. Notice the date on here is 1966. The open discussion meeting that had been introduced by outside sources, by outside stuff, was in full swing for 2 or 3 years at least by then. And Bill Wilson, who's sitting in New York, gets all that information. Remember, in those days, everything that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous came back through Bill via letter or telephone or people who traveled and heard what was going on. But the good, the bad, and the ugly all came back to Bill. And he is hugely disturbed by what's going on because fewer and fewer people are recovering from this deadly deal because we're too busy talking about our day. It was fun, but it just wasn't too beneficial towards recovery. So this was his answer to what he was hearing. Now, though a member may sometimes be helped in such matters by his friends in AA, the primary responsibility for the solutions of all of his problems of living and growing rests squarely upon the individual himself. Now, should an AA group attempt this sort of help, its effectiveness and energies would be hopelessly dissipated. And here it is. This is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of a group. If we don't stick to this cardinal principle, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. Dig? You see, it boils down to just a simple perceptual shift in how we think about our meeting. If we always think about it as a sharing session for our day, we'll reap what the results were. If we can look at it as an opportunity to carry a message of hope and recovery to the new guy through the steps, then we get to see what those results are. And I've been doing this long enough now to tell you that if you'll address that, you'll see amazing changes in what you're after. One more thing I wanted you to read, I wanted to talk to you about. There was a fellow that I sponsor, still do, in Ireland. One of the coolest kids you've ever met in your whole life. And on that trip in Australia that I was at, I was talking to my wife one morning on Skype, that computer thing back and forth, like telephone deal. It's like 3 a.m. in Australia, and she's at work in Texas. And we're talking, and she says, "Hey, I've got Daniel on the other. He's on the email right now." And I said, "Well, what's he up to?" And she click, 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 and then she gets back to me and she says, "You ain't going to believe this." I said, "What?" She said, "I'll send it to you." So she forwards his email. He doesn't know I'm in Australia. She forwards it to me in Australia, and this is what it said: they had just published the revised service handbook in Ireland, and it said regarding the big book study movement. This is outside the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ireland. Dig? What this means, guys, is that if I want to go to a meeting and talk about the cat crapping in the garden, I'm perfectly within my right to do so. But if I want to talk about the big book and set up a meeting to study the big book, I'm outside the confines of that structure in Ireland. Is that not weird to you? I mean, I can show you groups in the United States now where they won't even let you bring a big book into a meeting. They'll stop you in the parking lot. You can't even take a book in the meeting. Places where they're charging money to hear fifth steps. Charging money to hear fifth steps. I mean, every time I say this stuff, I can hear Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob turning over in their grave. They're just crapping hearing this stuff. What? I know that some places AA is perfect still. I know that there are places, and I'm hoping it's where you go, where there's a good, strong bunch of guys doing the deal that they're supposed to do. But it's not like that worldwide. There is so much stuff happening, and you need to know it. You need to know it. Because there's no there. The only way you'll keep it from happening here is to be strongly grounded in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the literature that was given to us. Strong sponsorship always begets strong sponsorship. You'll always end up with real strength in the fellowship in areas where you're doing that. I think all of you guys are pretty clear on that stuff. I've talked enough of you already to know that there is such good, good, strong AA in parts of Sweden that that I'm optimistic. I feel really, really good about it. There are places worldwide, guys, where I've done this exact same talk almost word for word and had half the room gone. I want to hear it. I want to do what I'm going to do forever and ever. That's it. That's what they say. They won't look at the stats to say that our number of people recovering, number of people picking up 1 year chips, and this sort of thing is in the toilet. They won't look at that kind of stuff. We have the means right in front of us to change the very face of AA every meeting we go into. Our only responsibility is to know what it is, to have a clear-cut understanding of what the program was, which would be cool. One last little piece, and then we'll go take a little fast smoke break, and then Chris can come back and finish us up for the night. All of this stuff is for naught if we don't put it into action. We'll talk about this stuff some tomorrow. This idea that we can learn what's in the book and then just sit in a meeting and wait for somebody to come to us, or we'll sit in a meeting and just see how life unfolds, I suspect that there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that's not what the literature told us to do. One of the things that you find real quick when you get into this stuff is that we were supposed to go out and carry a message of recovery to the drunk that still suffers. We need to be ready to go do that stuff. Box 459, the newspaper of the General Service Office in New York that they publish every month, one of the issues last year was an issue in there where they were talking about how distraught they were that they had to make sometimes 12 telephone calls to find one person that was willing to go do a 12-step call. We ought to be spanked worldwide for that kind of crap. That is no excuse for that. It ought to take one call to a drunk to go help another drunk. That's what it ought to be. And the only reason I can think of that would happen is that we're simply not clear what our responsibilities are, and we're not clear what we're supposed to do to help that drunk. We think we got to be his best friend forever, and that we got to put him through law school, and that we got to have his just pay for his babies being born. Stop that! We don't have to do any of that stuff. All we got to do is help him get through the work so he gets a connection with his God of his understanding, and we're ready to rock and roll. And that's what Clifford was trying to tell me when I got to Primary Purpose. After I'd been there for a while, I'm sponsoring a couple of guys, and life indeed is better. I'm not thinking about killing myself, and it's just pretty good time. And one night I realized that there was so much more. I was sitting there. You ever sit in a room full of people that are doing the work, and you know they're doing the work by the way they look, the way they smile, the way they did. It's written all over them. This is a changed man and a changed woman. And I was sitting in this room with probably 100 people at that time, and I went, oh, shoot. I'm still different, aren't I? And as soon as the meeting was over, I called Cliff aside, and I said, I'm still different, right? And he said, yes, you are. See, I got a head full of knowledge about the Big Book, and what I want to do is go into a meeting and beat you about the head with that Big Book. Is there anything more ugly in AA than that? Seriously. Somebody said one time, he says, Myers, it sounds like you're trying to raise up an army of zealots. Well, it's sort of right. I want you to be a zealot. I want you to be enthusiastic about recovery, but I don't want you out there beating people up. It's ugly. It's not effective at all. Remember, this all boiled back down to unity, and it all boiled back down to love and service. We were supposed to, this thing about attraction rather than promotion. You're supposed to be attracted to me because of what I know about the Big Book and what I can hope to carry you in terms of information. It's supposed to be appealing. And yet there are areas that you walk into where you sit in meetings and it's just glum. It's just everybody. It's just I can't. You know, some of you guys have known it. Some of you guys that travel some have walked into meetings like that where you don't know if you're in an AA meeting or a funeral. Who died? You know, you just don't know because nobody's happy about being there. And it shouldn't be like that. It should be more like a pep rally. It should be something that's exciting to be in. And once you've experienced that, you know, I'll give you the Reader's Digest of this thing for 5 minutes. I told Cliff what I really wanted to do was sit in meetings and learn, but I wasn't too keen on carrying the message, and it showed in a lot of the stuff that I was doing. And so one night that I told him that I was different, he said, "You know," I said, "I tell you what, Myers, I want to tell you one more time what you can do, and then I want you to go away." And I'm thinking, he just means go away till Thursday night. And then it dawned on me, he meant go away, go away. And I'm thinking, where's the love? And he's loving me enough to tell me the truth about the situation. He said, "We didn't teach you all this stuff so you could sit and study. We're teaching you this stuff so you can sit, get a good basis, and then get off your dead butt and go out there and carry a message of hope. Because there are people who may never be here in this meeting. They may never get here. You need to go get them." And it was such a foreign idea. I wanted to duck the responsibility is what I really wanted to do. But he told me, he said, "Tomorrow night I want you to go to Salvation Army and I want you to go do this talk." And I immediately puckered up. I don't want to go to Salvation Army because the place scares me to death. 160 black men sitting in a room and I'm the only little white cracker guy sitting down there like this, just going. I just didn't know what to do. This wasn't a bigotry thing. This was a deal of just not knowing for sure what I could effectively do. And so I walk in there like this, and we have this meeting, and I'm so intimidated. It's like half the room has sunglasses on, and some of them are sitting there with their arms folded like this, and I am so afraid I can't. Listen, the reason that I tell you this story is because I know some of you guys, if you've never done 12-step work out away from your group, there'll be a time where you'll be faced with a room full of people that you don't know and you're unsure about what to do. Well, I'm telling you right now, there's no man alive that was more unsure about what to do than me standing there in that meeting that night, facing that big room. And so I start talking. We're reading a big book and I'm illuminating a few things like this. These guys start unfolding their arms and they start looking at me like this, and I keep hearing this sound and it's annoying as hell and I can't figure out what it is. And finally I figured it out. It's metal chairs being scraped on the floor moving closer. They're just moving closer to me. They were way back there when we started. And I'm not putting all the pieces together. I'm just kind of plugged into the zone and doing the deal. Some of you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm just doing my deal. When we get done, we all say the Lord's Prayer like this, and we're all circled up like this. And I got to say, as an aside, if you have never heard 150 or 60 black men do the Lord's Prayer in one room, do it. God Almighty! It's a chorus of angels could not have sounded cooler than those guys saying the Lord's Prayer that night. It was the neatest thing I'd ever heard in my whole life. The hair standing up on the back of my head like this, and we break, and these guys don't break. They're still just holding. This guy's holding my hand. This guy's holding my hand. And I can't do anything but squirm this way like this. And I'm trying to squirm. I'm not comfortable with this idea that they're still holding on to me. And so I'm thinking, there's still a great deal of fear involved here. I probably should tell you that in my old days in Houston, I'd gotten mugged twice by black guys. I was where I wasn't supposed to be at, doing what I wasn't supposed to be doing. And it had nothing to do with those black men. I was just where I wasn't supposed to be. But I was terrified of these guys. This guy says, "Can I ask you a question?" And I went, "Yeah." And I'm just kind of looking one way. I don't know what's going to happen. And he said, "Is there any chance you could come back out here tomorrow night?" And I went, "Yeah, I can do that." Yeah. It's like that. Again, the reason I'm telling you this is because it's not what I expected. You see, it's not what I expected. What I expected to happen is that I was going to walk out of that room and I was going to get on my cell phone and I was going to go doot and plug in Cliff Bishop's telephone number and say, "Okay, I did it," doot, and disconnect it. That's what I was going to do. All I was doing is doing this because to get him off my back and let me stay around a little while longer. So I did. You know, funny thing was, I woke up the next morning. I get up real early to go to work, like at 4:30, and I'm sitting there on the edge of my bed, and I'm going, why am I so anxious? And then I realize it's not a bad anxious, it's an excited anxious. I can't wait for this afternoon, you see? All through the day, I'm going, come on, tell me. This is. I want the day over with, because at 8 o'clock I'm supposed to do this talk. 6 o'clock in the afternoon. This is in Dallas, Texas, in the middle of the summer. It's hotter than hell. And I'm at 6 o'clock, I'm sitting in the parking lot at Salvation Army waiting for them to let me in. I walk in, I look like a drowned rat. I'm just sweating all over like this. I just kind of like, okay, let's go. Picture the situation. I walk around the end of this deal into this big gymnasium, and when I walk in, everybody stands up. All these guys are still there. They all stood up and they walked towards me real fast. And it scared the, you know what, I'm like this. There was a great big huge guy. You guys have heard me tell this story before. Like, I've tried to explain. This guy's shoulders were like this broad, and his head, my neck, I can't even, I'm looking right up in his face like that. And he's walking towards me too fast. You know how when somebody does that, you kind of go like, whoa, stop, buddy, you're in my space. Well, he violated my space so fast it wasn't even funny. He just went right there and grabbed me, and he puts his arms around me, and he starts squeezing, real gentle, but he's squeezing. And I'm just going like this, and I'm going, oh, geez, I don't know about this. And then he just kind of picks me up. And my feet are off the ground. I'm not even touching. They're just like this. And I'm pushing so hard, I can hear my bones cracking. I'm pushing so hard against his chest because it's just, my face is up against his shirt. I can't. It finally occurred to me, I never said I was sharp, and I'm not very quick, but it finally occurred to me, if this man wanted to hurt me, he would have crushed me seconds ago. And then I just realized, he's just holding me. And I just stopped pushing. I just dropped my hands, just like this. And I'm thinking, any minute he'll put me down when he's ready. And it just like this. And I got to tell you guys, I've been held by a lot of people, but I have never in my life been held by anybody more kindly and with such love as that big old black guy did that night. It was the coolest thing I'd ever experienced. And every ounce of fear that I had built up in my goofy little head went away. He set me down, and then he did something that I'll never forget as long as I live. He leaned over in my ear and he said, "We've been looking forward to you coming all day long." Left on my own devices, guys, I'm a badly behaved drunk that does very little right. I'm abrasive. I step on people. I say things I don't mean. Sometimes I say things I do mean. But at the end of the day, I just simply don't like who I am. And most people don't either. And here was a man telling me that he had looked forward to me coming back. And Bud, we had us a barn burning meeting in there that night. I'm telling you right now, I felt like Jimmy Swaggart. You guys know Jimmy Swaggart here? He's a preacher. And I it was just fire and brimstone. I mean, I was just like on fire with this stuff. And we got done with the deal, and we sat down and we said the Lord's Prayer. And I'm a trained professional now, so I know they're not going to let go of my hand like this. And we just sat there like this. And then all of a sudden, this guy says, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "Would you sponsor me?" And about 6 other hands shot up. And me too, just like that. So I go from this little goofy taker to a guy that now has 7 guys to get through the work. And yes, indeed, there was a telephone call to Cliff Bishop walking out of that lockup that night. But it didn't sound anything like what I thought it was going to. I said, "Hey, Cliff, you're not going to believe this. How do I get 7 men through the work at one time?" And he laughed until I was already out the car. He just laughed. You see? And everything about my life changed the moment I did that. Everything changed. Never was I again to go into a meeting wondering what I could get out of the meeting. I'm always at that meeting wondering what I can give to the busted up little drunk that's in that room. Always. And everything about my life has changed. I'm not nearly as abrasive. for some reason or another, my wife has chosen to stay. That little gang of daughters that I have, you know, to walk into a room and have those little girls all locked around me and have, they're like little chiggers all sucked up next to me. It's just the coolest thing in the world. For years, I'd walk in and you'd hear little feet running down the hall as they ran out the back door because they didn't know what was coming home. Is nice, gregarious dad coming home or is a mean SOB coming home? They didn't know. And today they know. It's Myers, the busted up alcoholic that's there to try to help another drunk. It's coming home. And it's good stuff. I can't wait to see you guys in the morning and we'll go through some of this stuff and it'll be some fun. And once again, I want to tell you how honored I am to be here. Thanks.